Welcome to the NHL Numbers Podcast with Brent, Chase, Corey, Jared, and Matt.
I wish you guys would watch the thing and report on the game. You don't look at the score and say, oh, 7-0, just absolutely got smoked.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the debut edition of the revamped NHL Numbers Podcast. You might remember us from such other podcasts as the Driving Play Podcast. Let me introduce you to your NHL Numbers Podcast crew. I'm Jared from Driving Play. Also from Driving Play, we've got Chase.
How you doing, everybody?
And Brent.
How's it going?
And Matt.
What's up, everybody?
And also the Driving Play Podcast regular, we have Corey from Shutdown Line.
How's it going, everyone?
We've got a great show today. We got some really, really good guests. We got James Myrtle from the Globe and Mail up in Toronto. And also Corey Pronman from ESPN and Hockey Prospectus will be talking to us about scouting, the draft, and prospects. So we will start with the James Myrtle interview. We are privileged to be joined by James Myrtle of the Globe and Mail. Welcome, James. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
All right, let's get right to it. The first question we have for you is about the Montreal Canadiens hiring of Marc Bergevin as their GM. What are your overall thoughts there?
I think it's an interesting hire. You know, I think mostly what Bergevin is known for is his personality and his ability to scout very well. And what he's going to need in terms of around him is going to be some very experienced personnel to deal with things like CBA issues, working out contracts, things like that. I mean, that's definitely not his forte. So in terms of someone who's popular, who has a good reputation in the NHL, who speaks French, who's from Montreal, they hit those marks. And it's going to be interesting to see how he does in terms of his limited experience. You know, you look at a lot of the successful GMs since the lockout, since the new CBA came in, a lot of the most successful GMs were not really, really good NHL players. And I think he could probably draw a correlation there, perhaps, between the way people like Peter Chiarelli and Mike Gillis and, Ken Holland, you know, a lot of these guys have a lot of experience as executives or are highly educated, as with Mike Gillis, and aren't necessarily from a scouting or playing in the NHL kind of background. So We'll see. You know, I'm a little bit more skeptical than a lot of people on this, but I think it comes down to who Bergevin hires to do some of the legwork around him.
On that note, I'm just stealing this from an article you wrote, but you have a quote from him saying, "My strength is not in numbers, salary cap stuff, but I will learn. I always tried to realize what I could do and what I couldn't do." Do you see him as the kind of guy that's willing to surround himself with people that are smarter than him in those areas and give them more power than most GMs would?
Yeah, from what I've heard, that's the plan with him anyway. You know, it sounds like Rick Dudley, who has been a GM and has been an executive for a long, long time, is going to be the guy that comes in. And, you know, some people have told me that they think that Dudley is going to be the de facto GM in that he's going to have a lot more power than most assistant GMs have. And then they're going to have a capologist that comes in. They're going to have, you know, basically a lot of personnel to support him. You know, I almost wonder if Bergevin, I don't know if figurehead's the right word, but he's going to be sort of the face of the franchise a little bit. He's going to be someone who works with the media and who also has a very strong scouting background, so he can bring that to the table. And, you know, I think it's going to be more difficult for him than some of the other guys I mentioned, like a Chiarelli and some of those. But if he's willing to listen to people around him, maybe they can make it work. You know, I like the components of the roster they have in Montreal. I think that's a team that you could turn around in pretty short order if you make the right decisions.
Bergevin's scouting experience was in Chicago. Our Chicago guy, Matt, has a question about that.
Well, you know, obviously Chicago has built itself sort of in the Detroit model of relying heavily on territorial play. Obviously Montreal has been, over the last few years, themselves a pretty good territorial team, but do you think that is going to be the type of player that Bergevin will mostly look for?
That's a good question. I would think so, yeah. You know, especially, you know, if we're looking at a Bergevin-Dudley combo, I think that you're going to see some elements of what happened in Chicago and Montreal. I think that they're going to try and build in that direction and not necessarily go for, more traditional things. Like, they're not going to look for just for toughness or anything like that. And it's probably a good fit in Montreal, too, given, you know, that's not the biggest team, and they could play a pretty good possession-style game. And, you know, it's obviously going to depend on what coach they bring in there, but the early rumors are guys like Joel Quenneville and people along those lines. So I wouldn't be surprised at all if that's the way that the Habs go.
One guy the Habs were rumored to be hiring as the GM was Pierre Maguire. Do you think those are serious rumors or just hopeful Americans that didn't want to hear him on TV anymore?
Those were serious rumors. No, they absolutely were. And the reason is that Jeff Molson and Pierre Maguire are very close. Pierre Maguire has some limited experience as an executive. You know, he was with the Penguins team that won the Cup all those years ago. He worked with the Hartford Whalers briefly. And like I said with Bergevin, it might be the case where they want someone there who's the face of the franchise, to be very good with the media, and to be able to handle that all really well. And I'm sure Pierre would be fine at that. It wouldn't have been a very safe hire, I'll put it that way. You know, that's definitely very risky. But I think it comes down to the relationship that the owner has with him, and that's why he came down to be one of the final guys.
Okay, let's turn to other GMs who are on the hot seat or might be, like Steve Zambellini in Edmonton, and obviously Scott Housen in Columbus, and then closer to your neck of the woods, Brian Burke in Toronto. How worried should those guys be about getting replaced this summer, and how long is their leash?
Well, it depends on the guy. You know, I think that you said Burke, Housen, and who were the other ones?
Zambellini.
So, you know, I would say, out of those three, that Zambellini is probably the safest, even though they've had such limited success there. Scott Housen is definitely in big trouble. A lot of people are going to be surprised if he's back next year. So far, they haven't made that change, so it looks like he's going to be there. But they brought in Craig Patrick to do a lot of the duties there, too. So it might almost be a case where Housen has given up some of his control of the team. Burke is definitely getting this season to figure things out, and they have an ownership change here in Toronto. So, you know, it makes it complicated, I think. And, you know, with an ownership change and a CBA change, it would have been tough to change GMs in Toronto this summer. And it's really going to depend how the team does on the ice, whether or not Brian Burke stays. You know, I believe that if they miss the playoffs again and have a season as bad as they did this year, where, you know, the low end of the Eastern Conference, I think they're going to have to look really long and hard about moving on from the Burke era and bringing someone else in. And so essentially, I think that all those guys are in trouble to various degrees. Tambellini's probably got another couple of years just with the way that they're trying to go the long and patient route, but they could all be gone within the next two seasons.
Okay, there's a summer move that Burke might be involved in. Chase, did you want to talk about that?
Going back to what you said about Burke, just as a quick point, the Leafs have $56 million committed for next season right now, but the year after, they only have $34 million, so if Burke's on the hot seat this season, then that would kind of be interesting, because it looks like 2 years is really going to be the year where they have a lot of room coming off. So if they do make the playoffs this year, I just think that could be definitely an interesting, you know, kind of saving grace for Burke, just because the Leafs have so much money coming off the books in two seasons rather than one. But I guess that kind of leads into my next question about one guy who's going to be a really hot commodity this offseason is going to be Luongo. Where might you see him ending up? Because I know there's a few teams that he said that he'd be willing to waive his no-trade clause for.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a tough deal for Vancouver to make, and I don't think they're going to be able to get much back in return just because of, well, you know, all the factors. The contract's one of them, and the fact that Luongo can name where he wants to go. I think he's named four teams at this point, Tampa Bay, Florida, I guess New Jersey's in there, Chicago, Toronto. Four or five, anyway. The Canucks aren't going to trade him to Chicago. Brodeur's played well in these playoffs, so I don't think he's going to go to New Jersey, because it looks like Brodeur's still going to be the guy there. It doesn't sound like Florida is interested at all. So that leaves you with Tampa Bay and Toronto among the teams that are on Luongo's list, and those seem the most likely to me. The Lightning have not made it clear whether or not they're interested yet. I'd have to think they would be, because they definitely need a goaltender, but you know, their salary structure is complicated with all the big money guys they have there. And, you know, they need some help probably on defense as well. And Toronto, you know, I think if Luongo's actually seriously interested about coming to Toronto, I think that probably makes the most sense, especially if Vancouver's willing to take back a salary or even just to give up Luongo for a third round or a fourth round pick or something like that. I think it makes sense for Toronto to do that because they need to get better in goal and they need to get better there in a hurry. And that's one cheap way to do it. And I think the contract isn't nearly as problematic in Toronto as it would be in some other places because, you know, there's so much money here that if there's ever any kind of an amnesty buyout or you want to put a guy in the minors or you want to eat some salary on a contract, whatever the new CBA allows, you're going to be able to do that in Toronto. So I think that it makes a lot of sense for him to come to Toronto or Tampa Bay, and that's where I think he's going to end up.
And then on the Vancouver side, Gillis just got an extension. How do you think that will affect the situation, and were you surprised at all there?
I think Luongo is going to go, and I'm not surprised that Gillis is staying either. I mean, you know, regular season-wise, under Gillis, the Canucks have been the most successful team in the league. So, you know, it makes sense. He has a good relationship with the owner there, too, which matters. And I think what he's going to try and do is bring in an asset that's going to make the Canucks better next season for Luongo. Either he can use the cap space that he gets from Luongo or he can get something back for him, which, you know, as I said, is probably going to be pretty tough. So, yeah, I think the Luongo trade is going to be a big part of what Gillis's next couple years look like. You know, the fans in Vancouver are still unhappy with the Cody Hodgson trade, and they're questioning Gillis, I think, a lot more than they were before that deal was made. So it's going to be a big one for him.
On a Vancouver note, this is somewhat old news, so we'll just touch on it briefly, but you seem like the perfect guy to ask. You're originally from Kamloops in central British Columbia, and now you obviously live and work in Toronto, so you could give us a balanced perspective there. What do you think of the narrative that the rest of Canada has a healthy dislike, we'll say, for the Canucks, and specifically the national media and Toronto media?
Oh, I don't know about the media having a dislike. You know, I think that fans in general don't really like the Canucks, and if you're sensing that in the media, probably what it is that the Canucks team isn't really the most charismatic group of guys. They're not always the easiest to deal with. So if you get that blowback, that's probably what it is. You know, guys like Kessler are tough to talk to sometimes, or a bit prickly. Luongo. You know, I think that what rubbed a lot of Canadians the wrong way was just the way everything went down in Vancouver with the riots, with the way the team played in that final series where they were sort of falling over. And, just in Toronto, my sense was that a lot of the hockey fans wanted Boston to win that series, and it didn't have anything to do with whether or not there was a Canadian team in there or not. They just liked the team better and the way they played better. So I think that that's part of the backlash, and I think that if you got that in the media, that they were just picking up on that same sort of sense about that series.
Okay, on a league-wide note, Bettman announced today that a group led by former Sharks CEO Greg Jamieson are going to buy the Phoenix Coyotes, and they claim they're going to try to keep them in Glendale. What are your thoughts there, and how do you see the prospects of cities like Seattle, Kansas City, and obviously the big one was Quebec City getting a team in the near future?
I don't think the prospects are very good for Kansas City or Seattle. The NHL, I know, is really interested in Seattle and would like to go there. They need that a new arena to come in because the existing one isn't going to work for hockey. So I think if we're talking about Seattle, it's probably something that's at least 3 or 4 or 5 years away because they got to have that arena built. Kansas City, there has never, you know, the arena's been there for a few years now. There's never been an ownership group that's ever come forward and said, we want to go to Kansas City. They've already got the two pro sports teams there. It's not a very big city, and they're happy with the arenas making enough money off concerts and things like that. They're happy enough with that. If Seattle is a 3 or a 4 year thing, then I think Kansas City is probably even longer than that. And then you get into discussions about Quebec and, you know, even the Greater Toronto area is getting another team. I think that Quebec is the most realistic place for a team to go to, and I think that if everything falls apart in Phoenix, which it still could, that's probably what they're going to have to do. It's the same thing that happened last year with Atlanta to Winnipeg, Quebec's ready to take the team and put it in their ancient arena in Quebec City for a couple of years. They'll do that. I mean, they have an owner there who wants the team badly, as badly as they wanted it in Winnipeg, who has tons of money, and who's willing to do whatever it takes to get the team. So, you know, if the Coyotes are available tomorrow, they're going to go to Quebec City, because I just don't think there's a fit anywhere else right now. And then the other option is here in Toronto or nearby, and that's going to be a complicated one for the league and for the Leafs and everything to figure out. But I think eventually, you know, in the next 10 years, that's going to happen as well. So I think what the NHL is hoping is that the league's going to stabilize a little bit, and then they can expand in some of these markets. They'd like to expand into Toronto because they can charge a fortune in expansion fees for that team. And then they'll expand into a Seattle or maybe even Quebec City if Phoenix does end up staying where they are. You know, the announcement yesterday didn't really give me a ton of confidence that they're going to be able to get it done, but they are getting a little bit closer, and we'll see. I mean, it's incredible the amount of money that Glendale is willing to pay to keep that team, but the fact that they are, that might be enough to keep them. You know, the fact that they're willing to pay $15 or $16 or $17 million a year, that might be enough to save them.
Okay, and Corey actually had a question about Phoenix as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, I just wanted to get your thoughts on a team owned by the NHL possibly being in the Stanley Cup final and even winning the Stanley Cup.
Yeah, it's kind of bizarre. You know, as a reporter, I mean, that's a good story. You know, if that ends up happening, I think that's going to be fascinating to watch. And people have been making jokes on Twitter almost every day about, oh, you know, Bettman can get his name on the cup now and things like that. You know, I think the league, that announcement yesterday was in part because they want to sort of make it look like there's about to be an owner. You know, it would be a black eye on the league if we were in the Stanley Cup final. They're going to get more and more national media attention in the finals. People are going to, you know, the New York Times and Sports Illustrated and a lot of the big publications will be there for that, and they'll be talking about the Coyotes' ownership situation, and they want to say, we've got this guy Jameson who's ready to buy the team here really soon. They don't want to say, oh yeah, this team's owned by the league. It's been owned by the league for 3 years since that bankruptcy. It's a complete disaster. You know, they want it to look like it's about to be wrapping up and to be finished, but it's, you know, in truth, I don't think it is. So, it's going to be interesting. And if there are any controversial calls that go the Coyotes' way, I'm sure people are going to say, oh, you know, that's what Bettman wanted. When, you know, in fact, I think the NHL would rather have a big media market like L.A. In the final or the Rangers. I mean, they would love a New York, Los Angeles Stanley Cup final. That would draw big numbers on NBC. So, you know, what the NHL wants, I'm sure, is that. You know, I don't think they're even crazy about the Coyotes winning the Stanley Cup.
All right, let's go ahead and take a look at the Coyotes' Western Conference opponents, the Kings. Based on an article I read this morning, it looks like you have warmed to the Kings. I remember earlier you tweeted that you thought the Canucks were an easy pick in the first round. So what has changed your views on the Kings that maybe what do you like about them you didn't like before?
Well, the West is thinning out. You know, there aren't a lot of contenders left. And it's interesting, you know, in the piece I wrote yesterday looking at the Kings, they essentially have been a different team than they were the first half of the season. I mean, the problem in L.A. was always that they couldn't score any goals. They had to win every single game 2-1 or 1-0. I think I read that Jonathan Quick was in the most 1-0 games of any other goalie in the league this season. But, you know, since they got Jeff Carter, since they moved out Jack Johnson, they've been a different team. They've been scoring a lot more goals. They have better depth. Dustin Penner's come alive. They called some guys up from the minors like King and Nolan who have contributed. And they've had fantastic goaltending, which they had all year. So, you know, you had the coaching change. You had that trade for Jeff Carter. And some guys that were in a funk like Penner have begun producing. So, you know, they're an eight-seeded team, but they don't really look like an eight-seeded team right now. And you know, the reason I've changed my mind is because I think that the Kings might end up winning the Cup now just with how they're playing. So it's pretty interesting. You know, we've never seen in the NHL a team ranked lower than ninth overall ever win the Cup. And I think that was the Devils during the lockout shortened year. Since the lockout, the lowest-seeded team, I think, was the Penguins were eighth when they won the Cup. And everybody else has been higher than that. You know, it's always been teams that were ranked first or second or third or fourth or whatever in the NHL. So for a team like LA, or even, I think they were 15th in the NHL this year, for a team like them to win, nothing like that's ever happened in the NHL before. So pretty remarkable, you know. I think at this point still you have to say that maybe the Rangers are the favorite just because they had a great regular season, but it's going to come down to 6 or 7 games and a bunch of overtime games. So good luck predicting that.
Other than the Kings, what is your biggest surprise in the playoffs? Maybe if not a team, a player?
I think that the other really big surprise for me has been New Jersey. You know, I didn't think New Jersey was going to be much of a contender at all. You know, getting past Florida, sure, that, you know, Florida, what, didn't have a very good team either. But the Devils have really impressed me. And it's been a lot of their lesser guys. You know, they've been playing guys like Bryce Salvador, like 23, 24 minutes, and he's done really well. Henrique, the rookie who was in the AHL last year, looks like a veteran. I mean, he's scoring all the big goals. You know, there's a and Marty Brodeur has been not excellent, but he's been good enough for them to win. So New Jersey's not a team. You know, I picked the Flyers to sweep that series and win it, and it looks like they're going to lose. I mean, they might even be out in 5 tonight. So I would say that the Devils have been the biggest surprise. LA, I can see that. Phoenix, I can see that just because of defensive play. New Jersey, I didn't hear anybody talking about New Jersey coming into the playoffs, and now it looks like they're going to go to the Final Four.
Brent, did you have any comments on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they've certainly improved as the year went along, but I agree that nobody was actually talking about them coming into the playoffs. They didn't really have that strong. I mean, they had a strong finish. They won their last 6, I think, but, you know, the way they got through the first round, I saw you predict the Flyers in 4, and I thought to myself, well, you know, that's a bit extreme, but I think 5 or 6, I myself predicted Flyers in 5, but I've been shocked at how well the Devils have neutralized the Flyers' offense so far. And I don't see any reason why it's not going to continue. The Flyers' defense just doesn't have an answer for what the Devils' forecheck has been able to establish in these playoff games.
All right, let's turn to the Caps-Rangers series for the most part for this discussion. Block shots have gone up in recent years. I saw that you wrote an article this week about it. Watching the Rangers-Capital series, it seems like the defensive strategy is almost like soccer for a free kick where the guys just line up trying to stop the puck. And,
yeah.
And what do you think? Do you think it's a smart way to play, and what do you think is good for the game?
Well, I was talking to a couple of reporters on Twitter about this yesterday, and we were wondering, you know, this reminds us a little bit of when Montreal went on that run, that they, when they went to the third round, and they were doing a lot of the same things, and it sort of crowd the front of your net, block as many shots as possible. And I think what it is it's a response to puck possession teams sort of dominating and winning the cup very often. You know, it's a response to teams like Detroit and Pittsburgh and even Chicago that were winning the cup in 08 and 09. I think that, you know, those teams, they win by generating more shots and more opportunities and having the puck more often than other teams. The thing is, if you don't have a team that's as skilled as one of those teams, as a Detroit or a Pittsburgh, how do you sort of get rid of that margin there, that margin of them having a higher skilled team? One of the ways you can do it is you can block a lot of those extra opportunities that they get. You know, I think that's what we're seeing from Washington and even New York, and they did this all season, is that rather than relying on having a large margin of difference in terms of shots, they're just trying to block them as many as they can, keep the shots against as low percentage opportunities. And we saw that in the Washington-Boston series. You know, a lot of the opportunities that Boston was getting were really easy for Holtby to save. And, you know, he put up a gaudy save percentage number, and he was good. But part of it was is they were taking away all the high percentage areas on the ice. And it's almost like they've mapped out where they want their guys to be lying down on the ice in order to prevent good shots from getting through. So it's an ugly style of hockey to watch, and it's something I think that is new. And, you know, in that article that I wrote, instead of calling it the dead puck era, I called it the blocked puck era. And you just wonder if this is the way more and more teams are going to play. You know, block shots have gone from 24 or 25 a game up to 33 or 34. And in some series, like the one that we're seeing in the Rangers Capitals, we're seeing more than that. You know, we're seeing like 45 block shots a game, or in the overtime game, I think we saw 80 something. So it's definitely a change. And, you know, someone for someone who likes the aesthetics and finesse of the game, it's probably a change for the negative. But I'm not really sure what the NHL can do about it. You know, if it's working, then I think more teams are going to start to do that.
I think maybe one thing that might stop the NHL team from really adopting this whole hog is just the number of injuries that I have to imagine that teams are going to sustain playing this style. I'm just surprised that there aren't more, you know, broken wrists or broken feet or other or facial injuries that come from blocking a lot of shots. I'm just surprised that neither the Rangers nor the Capitals seem to have sustained many of these sorts of injuries.
Yeah, I was thinking about that too, watching some of the games. And, you know, I think it speaks to sort of the body armor that guys have now and how good the equipment is, you know. You see it often in NHL dress rooms now where on their skates they wear an extra layer of protection on top of the skate. It's like a plastic guard that goes over top of the skate. And that's entirely for shot blocking. And it prevents you from getting your foot broken by having this extra layer on your skates. It used to be that you would only see defensemen wear those things, but in the last couple of years, you're starting to see anybody that blocks a lot of shots is wearing those extra guards on their skates. And then I imagine that other guys are wearing, like, you know, making sure their elbow pads and their and everything and their shin pads and everything don't have any holes there and then the other thing too, and I haven't been in one of their dressing rooms in these playoffs, but I bet you those guys are pretty bruised up as well.
One person in particular I noticed that's really taken a beating in this series and over the years is Dan Girardi. Like, I noticed he's always one of the league leaders in block shots, and he's always leaving the ice because he has an injury, but he keeps getting out there. And I'm just impressed at how he's able to sustain that kind of beating throughout the playoffs and the regular season.
Yeah, no, he's been great. Girardi's been, I mean, there's a reason they sent him to the All-Star game as one of their guys. I mean, because he had a fantastic season, and he's basically taken over for Mark Stahl now as their top minute defensive guy that Tortorella really leans on. And I don't think a lot of people saw that coming a couple of years ago.
No, I certainly didn't. I thought, you know, Stahl and Girardi were the top pairing in New York, and I always thought Girardi was kind of the weaker link, and Stahl was the stronger guy. Stahl sustained some injuries this year, but I think Girardi might have been the stronger guy of the two all along.
Done either. He had a really fantastic season, especially for how young he is and as many minutes as they leaned on him for as well.
Yeah, I think in the coming years we'll see that McDonough is actually the guy who might be the better of the two there.
A big point of controversy this playoffs has been the punishments and at times lack thereof given out by Shanahan. Big suspensions include Torres for 25 games for his hit on Hossa and Giroux's suspension for a game. He got suspended yesterday for his hit on Danny Subris. He'll miss tonight's game. Shea Weber got off with a $2,500 fine, which I guess is the max fine. How do you feel about the job Shanahan's done overall, and what, if anything, would you like to see changed?
I think the Shanahan's in a really difficult position. You know, I think that the GMs, you know, initially when Shanahan came out and he was offering all those really big suspensions to big-name players at the beginning of the year, a lot of GMs were complaining, and they complained to the league brass, and you know, Shanahan was told basically to tone it down, and that was back in November. So it's tough because he is a league employee. You know, he does work for the general managers essentially. If they don't want him to lay down these huge suspensions, then he's not going to. And I think that that's why it's so hard to make sense, I think, of some of the suspensions that come out, and it's so hard to find consistency in what's being done. But you have to commend them for doing some of the things they've done. You know, I'll commend him for giving Torres a long suspension. I think it was a little bit too long, you know, if you look at what has been given out in the past. But at least that sends a message. At least Torres knows, you know, I better not hit like that anymore. And you commend them also for suspending guys like James Neal in the first round and Claude Giroux for the Game 5 of that series. I'm not sure that those things would have happened in the past. So they're moving, I think, in the right direction, and hopefully it starts to change behavior more and more. You know, at the GM meetings in Florida this year, Shanahan gave a presentation, and he said that it was changing behavior, that you could see in a lot of instances, you could see players pull away from hits from behind and things like that because they know that those are just a no-no and not to do it or you'll get suspended. they have to, I think, stay on message. You know, even when it gets to the third round of the Stanley Cup Finals, it gets to a big game like a game 5 or 6 or 7, I think they still need to throw guys out of games and still suspend them. So it's a work in progress. I can see why fans are frustrated because there's a lot of things that they're still missing or that they're not suspending enough. And the Shea Weber one is a perfect example. But there's a reason for that, and I don't think that Shanahan deserves all the blame.
Are there any rule changes you'd like to see? I know some people have suggested going back to letting them clutch more.
No more clutching. I think that, you know, if you look at this year, that there have been a lot fewer penalties called overall. It's been trending that way in the NHL, and especially in the playoffs, you know, the penalty calls are way down. I think what they need to do is go back to more of a crackdown and call a lot more obstruction penalties. Watching the game last night, the Capitals-Rangers, you can see when players are trying to make their way into the offensive zone, they're still getting whacked with sticks and things like that, and I think they need to call all of that. You know, there shouldn't be any, you shouldn't be able to slash the puck carrier at all, really, unless you're trying to take the puck away from them. You know, it shouldn't be any hits on the wrist or the arms or anything like that. So I think if they call the rule book the way that they're supposed to, it'll help open up the game a little bit more than it is right now.
All right, let's go ahead and return to the actual game on the ice. What are your thoughts on the Kings-Coyotes series?
Kings-Coyotes, I think that's going to be low scoring. I think it's going to have low ratings. I think that a lot of the games are going to be probably pretty boring. During the season when, you know, they're division rivals and it's sort of a rivalry that we hardly ever see in Canada and some of the major U.S. markets, but you know, they had some heated games during the season, and it'll be interesting to see with, you know, there'll be a lot on the line to see if it turns into a series with a lot of physical play and some nastiness. You know, I think that could be what adds some intrigue to that series because there's probably not going to be a lot of scoring, and probably the team that scores first is going to win a lot of those games. And there's going to be a lot of complaints probably in the media about the dead puck era being back. You know, it's especially if we're looking at a New Jersey, Washington or New York and an LA and Phoenix Final Four. I mean, that's pretty defensive hockey, you know, and a lot of the teams that people expected to be there in the end, like the Vancouver's or Pittsburgh's, you know, they went out early. So it hasn't been a great year for people that like finesse hockey, that's for sure.
Yeah, I believe there was a line brawl in that in the Los Angeles Phoenix game toward the end of the year. So I'm a little interested to see if there's any carryover from that.
Yeah, like I said, I think that's going to be what most people will be interested in that series because not a very sexy matchup. You know, I think the Kings have become interesting to people, I think, because they got some really charismatic guys. But yeah, I mean, if there's any kind of bad blood left over from that game, that's going to be what draws ratings and draws a lot of the commentary on the series.
The East is a little tougher, obviously, because as we record this, there are four teams left. What are your thoughts there? How do you see that shaking out?
Well, you know, it looks like New Jersey's going to get through, so you put New Jersey through, and again, I would be shocked if New Jersey gets to the final, just because, as I said, nobody was talking about this team. But if I had to make a bet, I would say that the Rangers are the team that's going to get through. They haven't made it easy. I mean, it took them 7 games to get past Ottawa. It could take them 7 to get past Washington. And it'd probably be a long series against New Jersey, too, which sort of leads me to believe that I think the team in the West is probably going to have a better chance of winning the whole thing, especially you look at L.A. I mean, look how easy the first two rounds have been. So, you know, if I had to make a guess, I'd say that the Rangers are going to make it through. But, you know, we'll see. We'll see. I mean, the predictions for pretty much everybody in these playoffs have been terrible. You know, this has been my worst year ever that I can remember. And it's almost embarrassing looking back at the bracket that you made at the beginning of the playoffs because there aren't very many teams left. You know, I think that the only teams I had alive going to the next round is probably, I think the Rangers will be the only one that can still make it to the Final Four that I had. So it's not a good year for trying to be a pundit.
That's James Myrtle from the Globe and Mail. You can follow him on Twitter, @Myrtle. That's MIRTLE. Thanks a lot for coming on.
Yeah, thanks, guys.